Hello and welcome to the first two-parter episode of the Desi Outsiders podcast. I'm Ankita.
And I'm Meenal.
And this week and next week, we're talking to Nishant Joshi from Alt Cricket.
So before we jump into the show, we want to tell you a little something about our guest. Nishant is a doctor based in London, but his medical degree isn't what pops up when you Google him. He's most well known for his contribution to Indian cricket journalism via his book, his blog, podcast, and most famously, his Twitter commentary. But what we're going to be sharing with you in these two episodes isn't just a story of how he got to where he is, but an in-depth conversation about parenting, culture, and adolescence that starts all the way back in 1972 when his father emigrated to the UK as a refugee from Uganda. He still managed to send Nishant to one of the most prestigious private schools in the country.
In this episode, which is the first part of Nishant's story, we discuss the various themes in Indian parenting that a lot of us are probably familiar with. This is the story of a little boy who was given the very best in life, but the best always came with a price. This prize was immense pressure on his fragile shoulders to excel in life, coupled with kind of sheltering from the outside world that rendered him incapable of facing his failures. And boy, does Nishant know the taste of failure.
We also have a disclaimer before jumping into the show, and we would just like to let you know that Nishant has been a close personal friend of ours for a very long time now, and so it may seem like we're laughing at his sorrows, but really it's all in good fun, and Ankita and I know that his tears have led to a happy ending.
So let's jump right into the show. Welcome to the show, Nishant. We've been really, really looking forward to this interview for a while now. We've had to cancel with you a couple of times, but you're a friend first and a guest second, and we're very happy to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me, ladies. I've been with Desi Outsiders since the very start. I've listened to every single episode, and I just love what you guys are doing. It's a privilege to be asked on your show.
Now, I'm sure that all of our listeners would be able to say this with me, because here at Desi Outsiders, we like to start every single episode at the very beginning. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your upbringing as a Desi Outsider yourself?
Well, I mean, the term Desi Outsider perhaps doesn't apply so much to me. I always saw myself as a little bit of an outsider when I transferred schools at age 11. When I was even younger than that, I was at an international school. So we had lots of people from all over the world, and there wasn't a single dominating culture, or religion, or race, or anything like that. And everybody was very amalgamated in that sort of way. But when I moved across London to another private school, that's when I started to feel a little bit of an outsider, to be honest, and that was just because of the ethnic breakup, and it was much less diverse, and there was the sort of sense when you walk into a room, people start to look at you. And that wasn't just because I was new. I knew that it had to be something else as well.
And Nishant, is there any specific part of your Desi or Gujarati upbringing that you've embedded in your life specifically?
I don't think so specifically. I mean, of course, you grow up and you absorb different parts of Indian culture. And I think that wherever your upbringing is, it's very important for your own identity to at least understand bits and pieces of it, if not the full picture. But my own family background is that my grandparents were born in India, then my own mother and father were born in Uganda and Kenya, respectively. And then I was born in UK. And so for me, I think that I've absorbed lots of cultures. I've absorbed part of the African culture. I've absorbed part of the Indian culture. I've absorbed part of the English culture and part of the British English culture as well. I mean, we have the BBCD term that we use, isn't it? British-born, confused, Desi. And I mean, especially having moved to Czech Republic, age 20, I really started to realize that the world is a place for traveling, and at least my family, I have a slightly nomadic mixed culture, even if my heritage and all of my parents and my grandparents were Gujarati.
Now, we know quite a bit about our Indian culture, and we know something about the British culture as well, but I'm not sure about Meenal, but I don't know much about African culture, and you said you imbibed a little bit of that courtesy of your parents who also grew up there. So could you tell us a little bit about the African culture that you sort of imbibed in?
Well, I think a big part of our family and our family's culture, and I think probably the same thing applies for every single Indian family, is the food. So I think that the food for African families who've moved to the UK or at least Indian African families who've moved to the UK, is quite distinct from our own Desi food, actually. So, for example, in Africa, we would have fried what we call mogo or cassava chips, and we'd put lots of chili on them, and that's one of my favorite foods. And we have that even very regularly now. And there's a special brand of Kenyan sweet corn curry, which my mum makes with lots of coconut because she grew up on the beach of Mombasa in Kenya. And then there's something that about having been to these places myself, it really does transport you back to these places. And when I have my mum's sweet corn coconut curry, it means that I'm actually transported back to the places that she lived, and the house that she showed me where she grew up, and the house where she was born, and all of these side alleys and the ocean of Mombasa. And you kind of absorb in that sort of way. Also, my parents still do speak a little bit of Swahili itself. And
wow.
I can speak little bits here and there. I hope you won't make me say anything in it, though.
So how many languages do you know in total?
I don't like to keep account of these things, Ankita, but at last count, well, let's go through them then. English kind of counts, I guess. Czech, I can speak fluently. Italian, Spanish, French, Gujarati, and a little bit of Swahili. So I guess you can call it six and a half languages.
So you know how you say bilingual, trilingual? What is six and a half languages lingual?
I think that would actually...
God.
Well, I think the name for that would actually be like sexual lingo, but then you kind of probably mean something else as well. So I don't actually know. It's a polyglot, isn't it? Polyglot is the word for somebody who speaks a lot of languages.
And you mentioned two schools earlier, and I want to know which one of those two schools was St. Paul's, because I know you went to one of the most prestigious schools for little kids in the UK. I mean, at 25, I look at a 15-year-old and I think that's a little kid. I think that might be a little patronizing of me, but still. Which one of those two experiences was St. Paul's?
So St. Paul's was the secondary school that I went to from age 11 to 18. But Hill House was the school which was probably a little bit more relevant in my upbringing, a little bit more relevant in my family's history, in fact, because, I mean, both my mother and father, my mother was a pharmacist and my dad was a pharmaceutical sales rep, and they moved to East London, a really dingy part of East London, which has now been rejuvenated since the Olympics and that sort of thing in the last few years. So it's undergone a lot of gentrification. But it was a very high crime area when they moved in the late 1980s. And since then, it was always my father's dream to send me to a private school and send me and my sister both to private schools. And the story behind that was that my dad was... I mean, coming to England actually as a refugee, my father was coming from Uganda in a family of six. And then he moved to London with my mum, and he watched a 60 Minutes documentary. And he saw this documentary on the school called Hill House, which was in the heart of Chelsea, which is obviously, I think it's the richest bar in the whole of the UK. And there we were in one of the poorest areas in the whole of the UK. And it was my dad's dream to transform our lives from dingy Newham to bright Chelsea. And so my mum and my dad worked incredibly hard and saved up as much as they could, because obviously the fees at these sorts of private schools are ridiculous. But on the back of that documentary, my dad saw that Prince Charles had actually been educated at that school. And as a refugee, to hear that a prince had been educated at a school, he just wanted me to go there. And so he worked incredibly hard.
He just wanted his little prince to go there too.
Well, exactly. And there was a lot of pride involved in it as well. Perhaps even a lot more pride than practicality in retrospect. But they worked incredibly hard, and they say that they were taking me to work in the back of their cars, and I would be in the little cot in the back of the car, or if my mom was working in the pharmacy, then she'd be working and she'd have me in the cot on the floor of the pharmacy, and they would work from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. and eventually they saved up enough money for me to go to that school age 3, and we moved across London to a much better area. And I think back then the house prices were a lot more affordable than they are now. For example, even me now, I can't, as a doctor, I can't afford anything like what my parents bought. And the story kind of starts from there. We transform from a very poor family in East London to a much better off family in Southwest London. And the attachment we have that with that school is so much that after the history of that school, I keep on going back to it, but it really is quite important in my own identity and upbringing and values. When I was 2 years old, my sister was born, and I hadn't even started school yet. I was still in nursery, but he actually had put my name down on the school's waiting list, which was actually 2 years long, because he was so keen for me to have that opportunity. And the very day that my sister was born, my father actually phoned up the headmaster of that school, and he said, "I want my daughter to be put on the waiting list." And he said, "Okay, well, what's the name of your child?" And they hadn't actually named my sister yet. So, so they just put her down as Joshy Junior.
Really?
Yeah. So, I mean, that's how much intent, that's how determined my parents were to have a better life for myself and my sister. And things kind of went from there.
And even though your parents, it was your dad who wanted you to go to Hill House, but did you feel as a kid that you were happy as a kid over there in that school?
Oh, I mean,
well, it was a long time ago. I know. I don't know if you can retrace your memory.
Overall, I can't say that I had a bad time there at all. I think just growing up in that sort of school environment where there's, even as a young kid, there's a lot of pressure to be the best. My parents wanted me to be the best, and especially my dad was just very much intent on me being the best. And I was with child geniuses, really. And we worked quite hard at school. He was quite enjoyable. And just being in the heart of Chelsea, heart of London, I mean, we would go for sports every single day in Hyde Park. That's where we'd do our exercise and gym work. And we'd run around the Serpentine once a week. And little me with a little me Chubsy Bubsy, running around Serpentine once a week, taking me half an hour and being a bit wheezy by the end of it. And we'd wear the special uniform as well. So if anybody's in London, they still probably recognize the uniform. They might have seen a troop of posh young kids wearing these knickerbockers and golden sweaters. So that was our uniform. So everybody would turn their heads whenever they saw us. And it's quite cool that even now, living in Southwest London, sometimes I go and run around the Serpentine as well. So I love London as well.
So what influenced you to take up medicine and become a doctor, Nishant? Was it your schooling at Hill House and St. Paul's? Or do you also want to join in on the narrative of millions of kids whose parents see beyond engineering or medicine?
So I think that from a very young age, I mean, this is what I was alluding to early on when I was talking about being pigeonholed. And I think it really is a massive thing when we talk about saying, okay, well, you're a desi, or you're a coconut, or you're a geek, or you're a cool kid. Those sorts of labels really stick with you. And that's why I really resent being called anything, because I don't think even I understand myself enough to label myself and say, you are this or you are that. I'm a constantly evolving person. And so to label anybody at any specific point of time is a little bit unfair. It doesn't do anybody any justice. And so that's why I think that, I mean, what happened is that my parents, especially my father, would always proudly show me off and to all of our family, extended family, and say, Nishant is going to be a doctor, he's going to be a judge, he's going to be a millionaire by age 21. That's what he would say. So he thought
he's going to be a doctor and a judge at the same time.
Yeah, he's going to be prime minister, and
so he has to be a surgeon and he has to be a judge, not just a lawyer and a doctor.
Well, he would change every single week depending on
his mood.
Well, yeah, and
on what documentary he watched.
Yeah, and 1 week I had to be prime minister. Next week I could be a doctor first for a few years, then prime minister, and then a lawyer, because lots of doctors convert into law as well, and lots of lawyers become prime ministers, and all of these sorts of things. And because my secondary school was also very good, and there have been plenty of MPs coming from there, and even George Osborne, who's now editor of the Evening Standard and used to be Chancellor just a few years ago, he was probably about 10, 15 years ahead of me at that school. And every single year we have a ridiculous number of successful people coming from that school. So expectations are always very high. My dad was always very focused on me going to Oxford and Cambridge, in fact. So much so that he would take us on reasonably regular outings to both Oxford and Cambridge just so that we would get a feel of it.
And so we've established, and you've also established, that you've had quite a successful innings with your schooling, so to speak. And I guess all these brilliant influences in the documentaries your dad watched and all the road trips to Oxford and Cambridge ended up landing you a seat, if not in Oxford or Cambridge, but at least at the Imperial College London for medicine. And then 8 years later, you passed out of Charles University in Prague with your medical degree. So what exactly happened there with the university switch? And why did it take you 8 years to get your degree?
A little bit harsh way of questioning that, Ankita, but okay.
You're a friend. I think I can be a little savage.
So when I was 18, again, just for the sake of context, because you guys are really doing your homework and really digging deep now, perhaps a little, very deep, in fact. So... In fact, a little bit nosy.
Well, we wouldn't be the Desi Outsiders if we didn't have a Desi auntie touch to our questions. So,
and if we didn't do the professional stalking, we'd really do that.
Oh, I got two Harriet the Spies around here. I mean, you know, it's important to note that there was always a lot of pressure on me to, especially as the firstborn in the family. My dad really wanted me. I mean, from the time that I got into St. Paul's, it was just... Okay, well, now he has to get 12 A stars at GCSE. He's going to get 12 A stars at GCSE. I'm just like, well, Dad, some level of me said, well, it's not actually as easy as just saying, well, he's in a school, so he's going to become the best cricketer in the world. He's going to become the best sportsman in the world. He's going to become the best student in the world. I mean, it's only something that I realized in the last few years, in my 20s, in fact, that... Talent takes you very little. It doesn't take you far along the journey at all. It's perspiration that will take you the longest way. And I really do believe in 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration. And that the hardworking and minimally gifted child will go a lot further than the slightly talented child who doesn't work hard. And I was a mix of both of those because I knew that I had an innate... gift of schoolwork, which I'm not really sure what that equates to in the real life, but I was a relatively smart kid naturally. But by the time I was in St. Paul's, which was really an ocean of just geniuses, I mean, in my initial school, much smaller, much more homely. It was competitive field, but I mean, it was competitive in the way that I was still, I felt like I was a big fish in a small pond. When I went to St. Paul's as a step up, I was a small fish in an ocean full of sharks, really. I was completely taken aback by just how competitive it was, just how much pressure there was, in fact. And I mean, I still remember in one of my first weeks when they're trying to establish just how good you are and put in UK, they say you're in the top set or the second set or the bottom set, or depending on how good you are, which stream you're in, whether you're in the scholarship stream or not. And we had a maths exam, and until then, maths had been my strongest point, and I was top of the class every single year since, well, we were learning to count since we were going from abacuses to long division. I was just the best of the best. And then I got to doing my first maths exam at the secondary school, and I think I got 70-something%. And I'd come in the middle of the class, and I remember getting the result, and I almost burst out crying because I just never had that sort of feeling of 70% middle of the class. What's happening to me? And so there was always a lot of pressure on me. I think even that was just a symptom of how much pressure there was on me to perform academically. And after that, it was just relentless pressure from my dad, especially, and the rest of my family, because especially on my dad's side, we have six people there, aunts and uncles. And so there's always that big pressure from them saying, okay, well, this is the boy who's going to go in with big hopes. He's been privately educated from refugee to royalty. We're going to go. And there was always pressure on me to have straight A stars and straight A's at A level. And I worked ridiculously hard when I was age 15. And I managed to get straight A stars, 12 A stars, which, I mean, I guess it doesn't really count as showing off 12 years down the line. But, I mean, it puts you in the 0.01% top of the country. And I did that through sheer hard work and just being put in that pressure cooker. But what happened the next year is that in my AS levels, I completely took my foot off. And I just thought, well, I got 12 A stars, I'm a genius, I'm the best in the country, I can just coast by now. Everything's going to be honky-dory, everything's going to be easy. Then in my AS levels, I got 2 A's and 2 B's, which it's not bad at all when you look at the rest of the country. But again, it was a moment where I got the results over the phone and I burst out crying because I didn't know how to react. And then the next year, I was applying to Oxford for medicine and I didn't get a place. And I didn't get a place because I just wasn't, my dad said I didn't get a place because Oxford didn't understand me and that they're racist and all of these sorts of things. So it was quite easy to put the blame onto other people. The teachers didn't vouch for me in the right sort of way. But ultimately, it was down to my lack of being well-rounded, in fact, because I was just so focused on reading books, so focused on academics, that I didn't have enough of an idea of the outside world. And I just wasn't exposed enough. My parents were very, very, very cautious about me going out by myself. Wasn't even allowed to cross the road by myself because my parents were so terrified. Into my teenage years, if I was to cross the road for a pint of milk, they'd always watch from the window. I mean, that's how careful they were. And it's that sort of thing which did have a negative impact ultimately, and something which only really came to light when I was in Czech Republic and had to fend for myself, really.
So you didn't get accepted into Oxford, and then what happened?
So I didn't get accepted into Oxford, but I did get 3 other offers. So you're allowed to apply to 4 universities for medicine in the UK. I got 3 offers. I got accepted into St. George's. I got in London. I got accepted into Imperial College, which is just down the road from me. And I think I got accepted to Leicester as well. No offense to Leicester, but I did apply for that as a worst case scenario. And I picked Imperial because it was just about 10-15 minutes down the road, quite close to Hill House, in fact, my first school, which is why there's a lot of sentimentality attached to this. And it just felt like destiny that I was meant to go to the university next to my first school, out of all the places in the world. And the thing is, I'd done so well at interview. I'd absolutely nailed the Imperial College interview that I don't know why I nailed the Imperial College interview and absolutely flubbed the Oxford one. But I remember the Oxford interview just being like a different level. I remember going to these 2 different colleges. And again, that was a time when my parents were actually both in India and they didn't trust me to get to Oxford from London by myself. So Oxford, for anybody who doesn't know, is about 50 miles outside London. And they actually told my cousin to take me to Oxford. Because
at the age of 17.
Yeah.
At the age of 17, 18.
Yeah, exactly. And I just hadn't been exposed to going these places by myself, which sounds a bit ridiculous now, but that's how it was. It wasn't that I didn't want to. It's that I wasn't really allowed to. And at the same time, I can't really say that I was too coddled or sheltered because I was also put under immense pressure academically. So it wasn't even as you can do whatever you want, you can do the supermarket checkout at Tesco if you like. Again, no disparaging anybody, but that's the sort of example that they would use. It wasn't anything like that. They were just saying you have to be the best and this is how you're going to be the best. You're not going to go to people's houses, you're not going to go to the cinema with other people, you're not going to go to parties. Girls, no. What? No. You're going to go to an all-boys
school. Never had a girlfriend growing up.
I mean, we were going to an all-boys school. There was just, as far as I was concerned, there was no opportunity to even be involved in any of that sort of nonsense.
Nonsense.
And I mean, like I said, Anki, that is a very loaded and complex question, which it's nobody's ever asked me before. And it's something that I kind of buried over the past few years because I just didn't like to talk about it. But to understand what I went through, and I suppose your listeners are the only reason your listeners would be interested in hearing this is how somebody's failed and how you can avoid failure, in fact, because at that age...
It is a success story at the end of the day, so we're getting there slowly, but we need to address where you were before that happened.
Yes. So what happened is that I happily was accepted into Imperial College. I was even considered for a scholarship. There were 300 very bright students. Oh, I was still talking about the interview, wasn't I? The Oxford interview. The difference between the Oxford interview and the Imperial interview was quite interesting, in fact. So I went up to Oxford into these two different colleges, and they were asking questions that I had never even prepared for. So my school had prepared us for every single eventuality, and these guys ended up asking us questions on quantum mechanics, and I had no idea. I was absolutely clueless. I remember specifically, they asked me a kind of softball question relatively, and they said, what don't you like about your current school? And my school, St. Paul's, was renowned for having quite shitty buildings, and it was built just post-war, and just everything looked horrible. And I just answered, because I was so nervous, I said, well, the buildings are quite old. And it's only afterwards that I realized, you absolute moron, you're at Cambridge and you're at Oxford 500 years old in a 500 year old room, and you're saying you don't like your school because the buildings are old. And so I didn't get a space in Oxford, despite all my exam results being perfect and my other side tests being perfect and my statement being perfect. I think I flubbed that interview. And Imperial College, I absolutely nailed. I don't really know why or how, but I was accepted with a very high consideration for scholarship into an intake of 300 really, really bright kids. That's another place where I also felt as a massive outsider. People say politically correct or not, but there was one of my first days at Imperial College, I walked into the student union and everybody else was white. And it just really struck me. I just walked into a room and every single person in that room, there were about 40 people, they were all white. And I'm not really sure how to address this, but all I can say is that there's no way that happens as coincidence. And I definitely felt like Imperial College was very segregated in the way that the white students would hang out only with the white students. The Muslim students would only hang out with the Muslim students. The confused Desis would only hang out with the confused Desis. And the Chinese students would only hang out with the Chinese students. It was very evident in the lecture halls as well, that whenever you would walk in, everybody would just be completely separated. And essentially what had happened is that at school, I'd worked so hard, I felt, between the ages of about 14 and 18, that I was just exhausted. Mentally, I was exhausted. I hadn't seen anything of the world. All I'd seen was the inside four walls of my house. And there was a lot of media hoo-ha going on at the time as well, saying A-levels are really hard. A-levels are really easy. AS-levels were really easy. And I kind of just took that to heart, in fact, which is why I completely flubbed my AS levels, because I thought, well, if they're handing out A's too easily, then somebody who's got 12 A stars will just breeze through this. So I was very complacent. I had that air of arrogance around me. And that same thing happened when I was in university as well. And this is why I'm so careful about what I say to teenagers now and young kids now, because I know that if you say one thing or even tweet one thing, which is listened to or read by somebody at a vulnerable or impressionable stage of their lives, then it can really make a big, big impact on their upbringing. And there was one occasion that really just completely changed my view of things. And it was after I got my offer from Imperial College. And they said that I needed to pass my exams, just biology, chemistry, and maths. I needed to get 3 A's, biology, chemistry, maths, and then I would be accepted. And at that time, I was also doing a module called Further Math. And because none of my offers from Leicester, Imperial, or St. George's needed that I do Further Maths, I decided to drop it halfway through the term because I just found it way too difficult, and I found it much more practical to focus on three subjects that I could get A's in rather than three that I could get A's in and one which might just tip the balance of things, because it was incredibly difficult, and I just wasn't getting further maths at all. Lots of physics. My brain just really wasn't computing it, and especially not very highly motivated for it either. And then one day the head of maths called me into his office, and he was known as a bit of a hothead, but I'd never spoken to him before, never been talked to him before, and he just unloaded on me. It was first thing in the morning, and he just started screaming at me, started shouting at me. He said, how can you drop this? How can you do this? How can you do that? And the whole point of it just seemed that he was trying to break me down, and for no good reason. And at that point, I was also running my first company during school hours, in fact. So I was at a stage of just, I'd got my offer from Imperial with a scholarship. I got my life on track. I was going to live at home. My dreams were coming true. I was going to be a doctor by age 24. Everything was perfect. And then this one bastard came out and he started shouting at me and ripping me apart. And I really just had to grit my teeth. It was about half an hour in the morning. He just shouted at me before class. He took me into his office. He just shouted at me and really tried to break me down. And I just did my best to stay silent. But on the inside, I was on the verge of, tears seems to be a consistent theme in my struggles. But,
good, it shows that the struggle was real.
I was on the verge of tears afterwards, and it was just a bit bizarre because at the end of it, the conversation, well, it was a one-way conversation. I don't know why, still to this day, he was so upset with me dropping that subject, but he, at the end of it, he said, look, you're a bright kid. You will breeze through university. All of what we're putting you through now is far tougher than what you'll face at university. And that kind of stuck with me, in fact, because I knew we were being put through a really hard time at school anyway, and that, yes, we were supposed to get 3 A's, but we were actually being asked to do a bit more than that. We were doing the extra work that nobody, that not many other schools in the country had to do. So I knew we were being well prepared. And then with the sort of media thing in the background also saying, well, universities are getting easier to breathe through, government is desperate for doctors, all of these sorts of things, I just thought everything's falling into place, and I thought, oh well, you know what, life is going to be so easy now. If this mean bastard is saying life is going to be easy for me, well, you know what, I'm not going to put in any effort at all. And I think after that, it just felt like a massive exhalation. It was just a deep sigh over the next 12 months. And it was just a massive feeling of decompression after being put in the pressure cooker for so long. Things like independent learning were just a foreign concept to me, because we were just being prescribed everything that, okay, you go home and learn this, you go home and like that. At university, it was a completely different kettle of fish. And because I was so close to live at home, because, well, my parents had worked so hard, I didn't want to spend £6,000, £7,000 a year living in accommodation, and then commuting from across London would take 1 hour my own home was only about 20 minutes away from Imperial College. So it was all just a massive exhalation, and I just didn't bother. I didn't bother. I was very arrogant. I thought I could cram in everything. And even after I'd failed the summer exams, they actually offered a chance to everybody to resit the exams as well. And during that time, I probably about 2 and a bit months. And one of those months, I actually went around Europe with my school friends, which looking back on it is very irresponsible. But at the time, it just seemed, well, you know what, I've got 2 months. Even 1 month will be enough to study. And sure enough, I didn't study at all during that remaining 1 month. Then I failed the resits as well. Then still, I thought, well, look, I've been considered for a scholarship before. They know I'm a bright kid. At worst, they're going to let me resit the year. And it's not the end of the world at all. So I was still quite cocksure in that way. I was still very confident that they wouldn't just let this bright... It didn't even cross my mind even once that anybody would let me not be the best, because I was so bright, I was so talented, and I'd shown so much promise before. And then I turned up to the sort of end of times interview that they have in September after they say that you failed your second set of exams. And there was no discussion, there was no negotiation. It was two elderly women. One of them was a professor of some sort. I can't remember who the other lady was. And they just said, you failed your exams. And I was with a chap who was supposed to be my mentor throughout the year, but was absolutely useless when it came down to it. They just said, well, we're not going to offer you a space again. Your space has been terminated at Imperial College. Just thought, well, but what about a resit? What about if I do the year again? And it came as such a shock to me. Like, again, I was in tears because it was just such a shock to me and I just couldn't handle it. And this all goes to not really being exposed to difficult situations when I was younger, I think. I was always with mum and dad and not really allowed to explore for myself. And that's a big reason why I wasn't really able to handle that year. And even afterwards, my family were talking about, oh, well, it's Imperial's fault. It's that lady professor's fault. She is her fault. They're racist. They're this, they're that. And for a little while, I believed it because it was the easiest thing to believe. It was easier to believe that it was everybody else's fault rather than my own fault. And it was over the next year where I just stayed at home and I was probably in a bit of a sub-depressive phase. I wouldn't leave the house for literally a couple of weeks at a time. I would wake up in the afternoon. I would have nothing to do. I would just wake up and be upset, really. And I would just watch TV and just hope for time to pass, hope for pain to pass. And then I resubmitted my applications because at that time I just needed to be carried on crutches, really. I mean, I couldn't do anything for myself. I was completely acopic. I was unable to cope with anything at all. And I wasn't doing anything at all either. My whole family were really upset. We tried to appeal to Imperial College, even through our local MP. My dad was so convinced that it was Imperial's fault that he went to our local Member of Parliament and said, well, these are extenuating circumstances. He was a little bit ill during that time and all of this sort of rubbish. And it just got to a point where I just thought to myself, like, this is just all bullshit.
And was it during that gap year, that year that you took out where you were at home most of the time, that your father said, or your parents said, you know, let's try and look for other options for you to become a... They were still determined for you to become a doctor, weren't they?
Yes, because they couldn't really accept that I had failed at anything. And I think on some level, if I failed, then my parents had failed as well. They felt that way as well. So they took some responsibility. And I could understand how they didn't want to cut their losses at that stage. They'd invested hundreds of thousands of pounds into me and my education. And even that itself had been, the money aspect had been something that had been impressed upon me since such a young age as well.
But at that time when you had... When you lost out your year at Imperial, did you ever think for yourself that, you know what, I don't want to do medicine, I want to do something else?
Well, yes, because I mean, I started my own logo and website design business. It was called Logo Titan. I'd started that when I was 16, in the summer that I'd passed my GCSEs. That was the year that I'd actually started it up. And for what it was quite successful. I earned a few thousand pounds as a kid negotiating these logo designs and all of this sort of, essentially being the middleman for lots of logo designs and website designs when I was 16, 17. And I would do a lot during my school morning break of 15 minutes and my school lunch break of an hour.
Did you continue this business throughout that year?
I tried to in bits and pieces, but as a person, I think I was so destroyed that I completely lacked the motivation. And I think actually what happened was that when I went into Imperial, that was the one thing which I did sacrifice. I said, okay, well, I can't be a medical student and this at the same time. Let's put that on hold. So in that year, I didn't actually do anything like that.
And then how did Czech Republic come about?
Well, again, it comes through more tears, to be honest. Because
more tears? I think the story is a slippery slope now. I don't know if we should go deeper.
Well,
I don't want you crying on this podcast.
Have you ever had anybody cry on your podcast?
Will, you could be the first.
Like, I just want to ask you, so during that time when you were feeling so low, did you at all consider going back to this business that you were having while you were in school? Did you ever think that maybe I can get back into it because I have so much free time now? I'm wasting my time.
Okay, that's a little bit brutal. Yes.
You said you woke up at midday and then you wouldn't leave the house. So did you ever feel like you could get back into
it? Yes, but again, I think at the time I didn't know it, but I'm sure that I was in a sort of subclinical depressive phase and I just wasn't fit for anything. I couldn't do anything for myself at all. And it's only afterwards when I started to learn more about depression as a science, years later when I sort of recognized those symptoms, I thought, actually, you know what, not leaving the house for 2 weeks at a time, not talking to anybody and not having an appetite and just waking up in the middle of the night and crying, that's actually depression.
Apart from the crying part, you just described my life.
Oh my god.
not talking to anyone, not leaving the house sometimes, just being antisocial, but anyway.
But Nishan, did your parents ever I'm sure they noticed it, but did they acknowledge it? Did they ever talk to you about it or try to help you?
Not once. And I think that's what kind of upset me in the end. And it was at a time when also my cousin, who was supposed to be sort of my big brother, and he was a doctor at the time as well, 2 or 3 years in. Nobody actually reached out and said, look, Nishant is really struggling. We need to carry him. And it's only since now I've been in a position of sort of mental stability for a long, long time where I've actually been able to look at people going through acute phases of distress, I would call it, where they're simply unable to do things for themselves just because of life and not through their own making sometimes as well. For example, if somebody has a bereavement, you know, sometimes you just really have to carry that person through that time. And friends do really help. But the thing is, at Imperial, I hadn't made any friends at all. I'd made a handful of friends, but because I wasn't living in halls, it's not like we were on best mate terms or anything like that. And all my school friends were at university and going off and doing successful things. And I was the one who was left behind. I'd gone from being the top to the very, very bottom. And that actually became persona non grata, because what had happened is that I'd applied for another set of universities in that year out. So my parents had forced me to apply. And again, I still had the 12 A stars on my record, still had the 3 A's on my record, still had the perfect personal statement. And I'd applied to a few other universities again. And I was accepted for interview for, I think, 3 universities, if I remember correctly. I was accepted to interview for Keele, for Sheffield, and King's College. I think that was it, perhaps. And what had happened at both the first 2 interviews is that they hadn't actually asked me, well, just asked me passing in brief, so what are you doing on your year off? And I said, well, I'd actually been to Imperial and it didn't work out. And they didn't actually ask me anything more about that. But I didn't get any replies from either of them. So I think I'd been put on the sort of question mark list for both of those universities. Or perhaps I was even accepted. I wasn't even sure. And then my final interview was at Sheffield. And that was at a time where I really did need a leg up. But I'd done 7 or 8 interviews by then, medical school interviews. So I felt like I was an old hand at them. The interviews were getting progressively easier because obviously I'd applied for an easier set of universities in the second round. Obviously, no disrespect, because I'm not really in a position at this stage to say any university at all is easy. And then I turned up to Sheffield. My dad had driven me there. I really did need my dad to take me places at that time because I was just acopic. I couldn't do anything for myself. And I did need that moral support as well. So we drove up all the way there and it was probably about a 3 or 4 hour drive up to Sheffield and did this interview. Then there was a mean, quite large Chinese professor called Professor Chan. And there were 2 other people in that panel who were quite friendly and empathetic and understanding. And he opened quite aggressively with a question that hadn't been asked by anybody. So he said, so what happened last year? And I said, I'd been accepted to Imperial College and it didn't work out. And then he was so just pressing on this one question. And he said, well, it's not anywhere on your personal statement. And you haven't actually disclosed this. And I said, well, actually, on the statement where you have to fill out all your forms and stuff, it doesn't really give you an option for any previous universities or any dropout sort of thing. But I mean, I felt that they'd asked me a question and I never really intended to advertise it. Fine, fair enough. But I'd also never intended to hide it either. So obviously I knew that would come up in question. So I was prepared to answer it honestly and said, look, well, I had a bad year at Imperial. But previously I proved myself to be a good student. I feel like I've learned my lessons now. I'm making corrective changes to change my study patterns and behavior. I still think that I deserve a chance to be a medical student. And again, he shouted me down and he threatened me. And he said, well, what you're doing is actually against the law and it's illegal. And we're going to report you and we're going to report you to all the other universities and all of this and all of that. And again, it was so shocking to me because, again, somebody was trying to ruin my life. It really felt like somebody was trying to ruin my life. And my last option was being taken away by this fat bastard who just would not listen to me. And he was so mean. And as a doctor, you have to be so empathetic as well. And the other two people were really listening to me. But this one guy kept on talking over me. And it was so shocking to me that, again, it really hurt my heart at the time. And again, I was in tears by the time I left. And again, tears, a common theme in all of this.
I hope we get to the happy part soon.
So I remember, and even the parting words when they said, oh, this interview is finished now, one of the other nicer people trying to be nice and seeing that I was so distressed and upset said, well, I hope you have a nice journey back. And I just gave them such a blank look as to say, yeah, right. And I went to the toilet and I just cried. And then I went to my dad, who was waiting out in the car, and I burst out crying in the passenger seat. And he said, what's happened? And I said, they tried to ruin my life again. And then we drove down to London, and then I was crying for most of the way and just trying to compute what was happening. And it was just an awful situation to be in, because the country where my parents had raised me, the country where we'd paid all of our taxes, the country where I'd been educated, had now essentially kicked me out of the university system. That's essentially what had happened. And then within a few days, I'm not exactly sure what had happened, but after the Sheffield thing, I think all the other universities at once sort of declined my place. That had only happened after that final interview. And until then, I think that I might have well been in with a shot. And yeah, that's essentially where we were at. And after then, that was about February time of that year. And again, I was just running out of places to go, places to hire. I just said, look, I'll go and do a marketing course. I'll start my logo design business again. I can earn money through there. I can do something. But I was just helpless. I mean, what do you do in your life when your dreams come crashing down? You get considered for scholarship at Imperial, and then within 12 months, you're out on the street. I mean,
were you more upset about the fact that you lost your chance to be a doctor? Or were you upset that you didn't have a chance to even get any sort of career? What were you more upset about?
I think it's a case of going from hotshot to nothing in a very short space of time. And in all of my expectations, I never even considered a worst case scenario, put it like that. Mm. There was no worst case scenario. My worst case scenario when I was studying medicine was, oh, well, if worst comes to worst, I might have to do biomedical sciences. And then I kind of just scoffed at the idea of that because I knew that things would never be that bad for me.
Oh,
but I mean, we laugh, but that's the reality of the situation. Mm. And that's, I was good. I was a good student at that time. And those were expectations. The expectations were that I would become a very young, very successful doctor, and that I would get married at a young age, have a really nice house at a young age, and everything would just carry on beautifully and perfectly. It was my sister they were worried about. My sister was a hopeless student.
Yeah, but then she got into medical school in the
UK,
right?
That's the fucking irony of it all. I mean, that's the disgusting irony of it all, is that my sister had was the one that we were struggling with. When it came to GCSE time and all of this, we weren't really expecting much from her. And especially after I got 12 A stars, she was expected to get straight A stars as well. I think she ended up with something like 8 A stars, which is still like in the top 1% of the country. But for us, it was just a massive disappointment. But still, for her, it was a little bit better than expected. So afterwards, they thought, oh, okay, well, we can apply for medicine for Neerja as well, my sister. Hello, if you're listening. And up until then, we hadn't really considered her as a doctor material. We'd considered her in weaker, so-called...
Wow, with 8 A stars. I'm not even going to say how many A stars I got.
So-called weaker profession.
Oh my God, I don't even want to mention that I was an English Lit graduate here.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Your parents must hate you. Oh, well, let's not get into that. But
this is not the story of me crying every other year. This is the story of your tears. So let's...
Wow, we should write a book, The Tears of Nishant.
But where were we?
We were talking about...
No, I was talking about my sister. Just for context, about my sister as well. So my sister, I think her career guidance counselor or whoever had said, okay, Neerja, you can be a dental hygiene nurse.
Oh my God, with 8 A stars?
Something like that. Or before that, perhaps, that when they were considering careers, they said you can be a dental nurse or something like that. Or you could be a nurse or something along those lines, because they just didn't fancy her as a very good student. They didn't fancy her. And this is why I say, bloody careers counselors can have a massive impact on somebody. That sticks with somebody. If an old person is saying, you're going to be put in this box, bloody hell. It boils my blood to know that people are going through that every single day and that lives are being changed for the worse because they're being influenced by people who aren't qualified enough and are too lazy, really, to delve into the deep nuances of a teenager. You can't just say in a 10-minute appointment, okay, well, your scores say that you're going to be a dental hygienist. No! Where do we get the Kurt Cobains from? Where do we get the Einsteins from? Where do we get the Bill Gates from? Where do we get the...
Nishant Joshi's from.
Thank you. Look, we were talking about how we got to Czech Republic. I think at that point, my dad became even more bloody-minded. He started Googling, which for an Indian person at that time, it was just, wow. And back then, going to Europe for your education, it was just unheard of.
If you weren't allowed to even cross the road to buy a pint of milk, they were happy to send you away for...
Yeah, now you were crossing the English Channel, like what?
Well, that's how desperate it became. And my dad had done some research, and this is where the sort of prolepsis, as an English literature student, you might appreciate the prolepsis in that story, the seed sown at the beginning from the Hill House story, where my dad watched that 60 Minutes documentary. Now, almost 20 years on, he's doing research for my university in a much more desperate and dire situation. And again, I mean, he found that the Czech Republic were accepting students from England, and as long as you paid the fees, they would not really care who you were or where you came from. They just wanted your money. And so the fees were about £10,000, which were actually cheaper than what we were paying for my own secondary school. So my parents still were hurt by that, because the university fees in UK weren't that expensive.
They're about half the price, right?
Yeah, so they're a little bit hurt by that, and especially living expenses and all of that. It comes to £5,000-£10,000 a year when you're living abroad in any case. And then the admission process was reasonably simple. Me and my dad went to the Czech Republic in April, and this is how naive and stupid I was in some states. So I don't know whether it was just my mind being frazzled, but I mean, I had assumed that the Czech Republic in spring would be a warm place. It's in Europe and it's April, so it's going to be warm. And I remember going in just a shirt and a thin sweater, and I was so cold. I had just never been that cold before. I remember going to Prague and just freezing my bum off. And in Prague, they were saying you have to sit an entrance exam, whatever your grades. And I said, well, okay, fine. And then somebody had mentioned at the sort of the presentation where they're showing around the tour of the university in Prague, somebody had also mentioned that they had other branch in this town that nobody's heard of, and I really would like your listeners to tweet in if they've ever heard of Hradec Králové.
I have, thanks to Mino.
That's cheating, but it's a small city 100 miles east of Prague, and obviously I've never heard of this place. It's a harsh sounding place, realistically. It doesn't roll off the tongue. It means king of the castle or something like that.
Yeah,
I did used to know that, but or crown of the castle, something like that. It's really poor that I've forgotten that. But then I turned up to this place by train, and it was like the Soviet Union. I turned up there. It was so cold. It was a Saturday morning, and I expected it to be, okay, Saturday morning, April, it must be bustling with some markets and things. Not a soul. Not a soul. Yep. It was a vast, open space, and we had to walk about 2 miles to the university campus. I just remember it being the strangest place, because there was not a soul. And the train station was just like it was out of The Shining, and there was a vast Soviet hotel opposite the train station, which was just like out of the movie The Shining, and everything just seemed like it should have a Soviet sort of soundtrack to it from World War II, with people just being shipped in vast numbers on these trains to an untimely fate.
Wow, how twisted was your mind at that
age?
That's
how depressing it was. And the weather was so awful. It just felt like I was going...
But to be fair, Nishan, I don't think you could have come to Czech Republic with any sort of positive light after everything you'd gone through.
Mm.
Even if there was something to praise about the city, you probably wouldn't have found it. Because you'd gone through so much that you probably would have hated any other city in Czech Republic at that point, right?
I was just looking for relief. That's all that I was looking for. I was looking for an end to this torment, this turmoil. I still felt like I was coming to accept that it was my fault, but I still felt this horrible bitterness towards Professor Chan. With these sorts of people, you always just know that they're going to pop up in your life at some point. I just wonder what point in my life is going to pop up again. And same with this other female professor at Imperial College, Professor Jenny Hyam, who became like the scorn of our family, even though I was the only person to have ever met her, amazingly.
And we're naming names now.
Well, yeah, I mean, and if they're ever listening to this podcast, I would love to sit down with them for a cup of coffee and just talk to them. Now, as a doctor, as somebody who takes care of people, I'm in the same profession as people, and I'm just thinking, what were you thinking when you said these things? You left somebody out to rot. You threw somebody out on the street, and I know that in my heart of hearts, no matter how bad somebody was, and I've dealt with lots of bad students, and I get lots and lots of people working with me, I never just dump them out on their bums. I always make sure that there's some sort of aftercare for my patients as well. You have to make the most of somebody. If you're in a privileged position of being an educator, you have to make sure that this person is educated in some form. At least say, well, look, we're letting you go because of these reasons. This is what you need to do to get back on track. You know, there was nothing like that. And that's what burned me so much. It wasn't just, okay, well, you've been sacked from Imperial, but these are the other options. It was just, fuck off. That's literally what it was. I can't put it in more blunt terms. It was just them saying, fuck off. We don't care what happens to you next. But we were in Czech Republic, this completely vast, empty place, black and white, Soviet theme tune.
I'm sure your life wasn't black and white.
But walking through...
It's like we're seeing everything in black and white.
But walking through this place, that's exactly how it felt. And I remember going to this cafe, which is... Mino will know Café Popular. That's what it was called, Café Popular. And there were hardly any foreigners there at the time. And me and my dad walked into that place. And everything in the menu had meat because it was Czech Republic about 10 years ago. And we asked for something without... If we could have pasta without meat or the pizza without meat. Nobody spoke English, and we had to motion our ways through, and sure enough, it came with meat on it anyway. And the waitresses spoiled their faces and looked at us and gave us dirty looks and all these sorts of things. And when I walked into the university eventually, I heard that you can actually get into that university without taking exams, because I'd already passed my GCSEs. I already got 3 A's at A level. They were willing to accept anybody. So I just said, look, in my mind, I mean, it's just one of the most stupid decisions ever. And again, I wasn't thinking straight at the time, and I have my family to blame a little bit, because they should have been taking a little bit of responsibility for me, knowing that my mind was so frazzled. The logical choice would have been to go and sit the exam in Prague. I would have passed it. It was a simple, simple exam. And then I would have lived in Prague instead of this place. That would have been the optimal decision. But this place in Hradec Králové gave me a spot automatically, without any interview, without anything. They just wanted my documents and my money, and they said, okay, we'll take you. And then again, when the time came to September and I was shipped away, I cried. I just didn't want to go.
You cried again?
Yeah, I mean, who wouldn't? You've been kicked out of your own country.
You know, when I found out that I was coming to Czech Republic, I was the happiest girl on the planet, and I thought that I was going to study in Prague. So I packed my bags and I got to the airport, and then at the airport there was a taxi driver, and he was supposed to take us to our place, to the place I had rented, and he was driving for like an hour, and I was like, where's he taking us? And it turned out that I was coming to Hradec Králové, this Soviet town of Czech Republic as well. But
you didn't know when you
I had no idea. I thought that I was going to Prague. I didn't know I was coming to this faculty. Now, to be fair, when I had come, I'd come, what, 5 years after Nishant, I think?
Mm.
Right? Yeah, about 5 years after. It wasn't as bad as when Nishant had come. There were many more cafes, many more English-speaking people, so it wasn't as bad. And to be fair, when I'd landed, the sun was shining. So everything was happy-go-lucky for me. Everything was rainbows and daisies. And then you hear Nishant's story, and it's just a complete opposite.
Yeah.
It's a Soviet Union story.
Yeah.
It really was, and it was incredibly depressing. And then the thing is, my experiences of it were staying in these Soviet hotels. When you land as well, a lot of people are staying in these hostels, which are just from 50 years ago, communist sort of times. And a lot of buildings here, now it's a really beautiful place now because it's being renovated. But at the time...
Actually, at the time, you probably couldn't have waited to finish a degree, but now you like coming back.
Yeah.
So it's a big difference, isn't it? From when did you come here? 8 years ago?
9 years.
9 years ago, yeah. To now. When you look back at your life, things are so different now.
Yeah.
So you already mentioned something that I could really relate to, which is that when children mess up, parents kind of say that, oh, it's the university's fault. It's that one professor's fault. It's they're being racist or whatever. It's very common. I'm not the only one who can relate to this. I'm sure of it. A lot of, maybe Meenal doesn't, because Meenal's parents are quite different, because they have like, they have a very different value system. They would probably question their kids first, but
they would probably definitely blame me.
Yeah. So a lot of other parents out there are definitely the kind that would say, oh, no. We know that you made a mistake, but the convenient option for us is to blame the third party. We already know that this is how your parents reacted, but was there, when you were going through the Soviet Union phase where you saw Czech Republic
you know,
for the first
Nishant
time
makes,
and you were saying...
When Nishant makes Tears of Nishant Joshi, can there be a chapter called Soviet Union? My face.
Soviet Union, yeah. And you were seeing everything in black and white. I'm really curious to know how your dad, who had watched a documentary and sent his prince off to this prestigious school, I want to know how he was seeing it too. Was it black and white for him too? Was he disappointed in the place? How did your parents react to everything?
I think they would...
And sadly, that'll have to be the end of this first installment of Nishant's story. You'll have to tune in next week to hear his answer to the last question I asked and the many others that shed light on how he rose from the ashes, and also share the story of how and why alt cricket was born. Because we haven't gotten into the cricket journalism side of things yet. I really hope that teenagers especially listen to this episode, because it's crazy how much stress some of them put upon themselves in a frenzied obsession over grades and performance. So if you know any young adults out there who might benefit from listening to Nishant's story so far, please do share this episode with them. It would really, really help them out.
Do tune in next week where we unravel this beautiful journey. And thank you again to Nishant for being extremely honest and bringing the story to us. If you are interested in following Nishant, you can find him at Radio Cricket on Twitter. You can find us on social media at Desi Outsiders, and you can also drop in a mail with your thoughts, feedback, or questions to mail@desioutsiders.com. And as always, please rate and review the Desi Outsiders podcast on iTunes and tell all your friends about us.
So until next week with another conversation with Nishant Joshi, I'm Ankita.
And I'm Meenal.
And we are the Desi Outsiders.